possible in part by a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the KABU monthly movie night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM, where it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We call this show The Old Mole after Karl Marx's image of the revolution that works underground, invisible to the official version of life put out by the mainstream media and politicians, but which, like a mole in the manicured corporate lawn, suddenly pops up where least expected, aiming to change the course of history, to bring visible power to the 99% of the people who before had merely seemed powerless. The Old Mole Collective puts on this show every week here on KBOO to support and encourage those who work for radical change in the power relations that give so much to the wealthiest and so little to the rest of us. I'm Clayton Morgridge, your host for today. Our engineer is Joe Clement. On today's Old Mole, we'll be focusing on what our tax-supported governments are doing and failing to do to make our lives and our world better. Will our military intervene in Syria? How is the U.S. affecting events throughout the Middle East? Will the Oregon legislature, being called into special session today, go along with Governor Kitzhaber's proposal to fund schools by cutting the pensions promised to state employees? Will our dysfunctional U.S. Congress shut down the U.S. government at midnight tonight in the battle to prevent the rollout of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare? And could we eliminate hunger in our nation by expanding the list of who's eligible for food stamps instead of cutting it, as many in Congress are urging? Stay with us this morning for the Mole's perspective on these life and death issues. This show will be available to listen to again or to download in case you want to hear any of it again or recommend it to friends. Just go to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show should be up in a day or two. And now, here is the Old Mole's Bill Resnick to talk with Chris Tonsig of the Middle East Research and Information Project about the latest developments in and around Syria and the threats of U.S. intervention. Bill.
Thanks, Clayton. Chris Tonsig, welcome to KABU.
Thanks very much, Bill.
Chris Tonsig edits Middle East Reports, a quality quarterly journal. Chris, some recent developments, especially around Iran and Syria, seem to many of us have profound implications on the Middle East and maybe even international politics as a whole. surely it raises these developments raise the possibility of some sort of settlement of the Syrian civil war and maybe provide momentum towards a democratizing reconciliation between a set of lethally warring interests in the Middle East. Maybe first describe what's happened at the UN around Iran and in Syria with Russia and the United States coming to an agreement on some sort of effort to end the Syrian poison gas capacity. And maybe after that we can talk about all the implications.
Sure. Well, last week there were two related and momentous developments at the UN. The first development was that, as you mentioned, the U.S., Russia, and other members of the Security Council agreed upon a resolution that empowers the UN's chemical weapons watchdog to go into Syria and supervise the destruction of the Syrian regime's chemical arsenal. And the important thing to note about that resolution and the reason why it got the support of not just the U.S. but also Russia is that it lacks a specified enforcement mechanism. There is no provision in the resolution for military action should Syria fail to comply, for example. That would require a second resolution. So this resolution is a dramatic de-escalation of the crisis, the international crisis over Syria, that seemed to be escalating toward the end of August when President Obama was rolling out his new product of a potential military strike on Syria. So that's development number one. The second thing was that at the meeting of the UN General Assembly, President Hassan Rouhani of Iran gave a very well-received speech, much better received than President Obama's, in which he held out the olive branch to the West. And though Obama and Rouhani did not meet physically at the UN, as many hoped they would, they did speak on the phone in a historic phone call, the first time that the U.S. president has spoken with his Iranian counterpart since 1979. And by all accounts, it was a pleasant conversation. And so it breaks the ice at the very top between Iran and the U.S., and it holds out the prospect, at least, of progress not just on the Iranian nuclear issue, but progress on all fronts, all the frozen fronts that have been frozen since 1979 between Iran and the West.
Let's talk about the Rouhani, Rouhani.
Either will do.
Either. Yeah. It was quite amazing. I read a lot of excerpts. It was so sophisticated in terms of exploring a whole set of questions that have been bedeviled not just the Middle East, but international politics around religion and the secular state, between Sunnis and Shiites, between the U.S. and the Middle East and the question of oil. And he also reached out the olive branch to Israel, saying to some extent, and putting them on the spot and defensive, basically repudiating Ahmadinejad's hysterical stuff about the Holocaust didn't happen and misquoted but still alarming stuff about the extermination of Israel. It seems to me, tell us a little more about the speech and some of the, truly sort of, and also a statement about pluralism and the need for pluralism and democracy trumping religious, commitments.
Right.
To be nice about what you're saying, religious craziness. Why don't you tell us about that? It seemed to me really just an immense sort of change in tone.
Yes. I think there's two things to emphasize. The first is that we are seeing the return of competent politicians in Iran to the world stage. There have been 8 years now of Ahmadinejad, who, for all of his oafish comments about the Holocaust and other things, was at core just not a very competent leader, either domestically in Iran or on the world stage. He managed to alienate just about everyone, including a lot of his own coalition in Iran. And that is the backdrop to why Rouhani was able to assemble a lot of Ahmadinejad's old coalition and prevail at the polls in June. So this is a return of not just competence, but also a much more pluralistic, forward-looking, outward-looking sort of orientation within the Iranian clerical elite. It's still the clerical elite, yes, but it's a different kind than Ayatollah Khomeini. It's much like Mohammad Khatami and his presidency of the late 90s, and rather than seeing a clash of civilizations between, say, Islam and the West, or between religion and secularism, Khatami put forward the concept of a dialogue of civilizations, that could celebrate difference, respect difference, but still find common ground. And that, I think, is the tradition that Rouhani locates himself in, and that's what he was trying to revive.
Let me break in. In some ways, it wasn't just directed at the West. It was also, it seems to me, a challenge to Islamic fundamentalism and to the religious state, and also a reaching out to liberal Sunnis, that is to Sunni Muslims. It seemed to me to augur some kind of effort to reconcile the Sunni-Shiite. I mean, that's in some ways a phony split, but to create a bloc that isolates the Islamic fundamentalists.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so I think it's useful maybe to see Rouhani not just as a piece with Khatami, but also as of a piece with the sort of more moderate Sunni Islamists, like the AKP in Turkey, for example, or the Nahda Party in Tunisia, that have also made these noises about seeking to at least de-escalate the intersectarian violence that has plagued the region for so long now. And it's not accidental that the rise of that violence, now it coincided with the invasion of Iraq too, but it has also coincided with the presidency of Ahmadinejad in Iran, a very, you know, sort of a return to the kind of firebrand revolutionary days of the early Islamic revolution that sought to export the Iranian revolution to other Muslim countries, and by extension to support Shiism. This is a return to a much more sort of diffident and forward-looking form of Islamism that is still Islamism, and it's very firm on that point, but it's an attempt to assert a form of Islamism that is not fundamentalism, if you will. So I think that's right.
Is there any chance that some of the Saudi monarchy and its elite would in fact decide to accept that, to work with that offer rather than export of fundamentalism as a way of trying to protect themselves against their own fundamentalists?
Unfortunately, I doubt it. Mm-hmm. The Saudis, their behavior, especially in the last 5 years, shows that although they are usually called the guarantors of stability in the region because they're anti-democratic, and in fact, what they on many fronts they seek to stir up crisis because that keeps them in a position where they can present themselves as guarantors of stability to the West. And I think that's the only way to understand their behavior in Syria, where they have armed and funded some of the fragments of the Syrian opposition and then turned the spigot on and off, not enabling the Syrian opposition to become military powerful enough to defeat the regime, but keeping the pot boiling. And the big reason why they're doing this is because they see Syria as nothing other than strategic depth for Iran in the region, and they're trying to keep Iran tied down, preoccupied, etc. But without changing the fundamental formula in the region. Unfortunately, I don't see any sign that is changing. There was, in the late 90s, between when Khatami was president in Iran, there was an unprecedented Saudi-Iranian entente. But the regional picture is so much different now after the Arab revolts, and I think the Saudis do not see an interest now in having an entente.
Really? They're just digging in then and trying to maintain whatever their authoritarian sort of system.
Yes. Their number one goal, number two is detaining or deterring Iran, but number one is to keep themselves in power at all costs. And that means doing whatever they can to forestall the spread of the spirits of the Arab revolts to Saudi Arabian territory.
Right. This is your old Mole Variety Hour, the old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, Community Radio. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Chris Tonsig, who's the editor of Middle East Reports. There's actually few people with both the independence and the time and the responsibility to examine the Middle East in the way that Middle East Reports and Chris does. Few people and few journals. Thanks a lot for your work, Chris. We've been talking about the second Arab Spring, maybe, that happened last month, where in both around Syria and Iran, voices for sort of peace and reconciliation seem to have taken the initiative and put the U.S. on the spot in many ways. Chris, in Syria, another important thing, it seems to me really fundamentally important thing that's going to shape U.S. policy is that large parts of the Syrian opposition, that is the opposition to the Assad authoritarian government, changed affiliations. They went from the, quote, Free Syrian Army or the and the sort of a that had a liberal tone, a liberal democratic tone. They made a common cause with the jihadists, the Islamic fundamentalists in Syria, which leaves the U.S. without, it seems to me, with very few options except to work with Russia and Iran on forcing a settlement with Assad leaving, but some sort of government of reconciliation that would then struggle with the Islamic fundamentalists.
Yeah, I think that the news that you mentioned has a positive and a negative dimension. The negative first is that it is yet more proof, as if we needed more, that the Syrian opposition to the Bashar al-Assad regime is just very, very fragmented. There is no such thing, there never was a such thing as the Free Syrian Army that had a unified command and control structure, and this new coalition doesn't have one either. But it shows that the degree of chaos on the ground and also the very deep and enduring split between Syrians on the ground who are doing the actual fighting and the opposition in exile. What the fighters say in Syria is that we're in the trenches and they're in the five-star hotels. This proves that. But the potentially positive dimension of this is that we've always known that if there was going to be a political solution to this dreadful civil war, it would have to come about by means of negotiations between the regime and between the rebel forces in Syria, not the exiles. And so if this is a step toward making the rebel fighters in Syria a little bit more unified, then that at least creates a political address for the emissaries of the regime to seek out. Now, whether the rebels are interested in such negotiations or not is another question entirely. So far, no. Whether the regime is interested or not is another question entirely. I'm sure the regime interprets the resolution at the UN as a measure of buying time for itself to basically try to win the civil war. There still isn't much reason for hope that the civil war itself is going to end or sputter out. But this does at least change the picture in terms of a solution that can be envisioned. And you're right that international involvement will be absolutely crucial, and that means both the United States and the West, and it means Russia and Iran pressing the Syrian regime to realize that it's never going to win on the battlefield and it's never going to rule Syria again. And the only way to avoid dragging the country through all the circles of hell is to sit down and negotiate some kind of political transition to a new government.
Mm-hmm. And the U.S., Russia, and Iran they actually have a common interest, a very strong common interest, it seems to me, in defeating the sort of al-Qaeda forces or the Islamic State, fundamentalist Islamic State forces in Syria.
All the states in the region have an interest in preventing those groups from, you know, becoming the new government in Syria.
Yeah, and in fact, that has to be sort of the U.S. goal, because the U.S. goal of regime change towards some sort of liberal secular state just is not going to. I mean, the chances of that are now so slender that you would think if they're rational in Washington, they would promote that sort of idea.
Yes, I think so.
Let's talk about the larger issues. I think we only have another couple minutes. The Israelis are clearly extremely challenged by the new Iran, and at least the new Iranian, the faction in Iran who now seems to have the initiative in Iran. How is the U.S. going to deal with that? What's your sense?
Well, I think the U.S. is hopeful now with this thawing of relations between Washington and Tehran that it can forestall the pressure from Netanyahu to mount some kind of military strike on Iranian nuclear facilities. That has been Netanyahu's game now for a long time, that they don't want to do the strike themselves. They want to goad the U.S. into doing it on Israel's behalf. And I think the chances of that happening have diminished now. Now, Netanyahu is going to come to the States shortly, and he will be making speeches himself, and he will be using the megaphone provided by the corporate American media as well to portray Iran as not to be trusted, a Persian peril that is, you know, a wolf in sheep's clothing or something like that, similar to what he tried to do last year with that famous and widely mocked speech in which he held up the cartoon of the bomb and so on. And that, you know, he'll try that again, and we'll see. I think the environment for that kind of rhetoric is not as friendly as it was last year or some years ago, because of the war weariness of the American public, the focus of the American public on the economy and other domestic issues. I just don't see Netanyahu getting a very ready audience for that message, although, of course, he will try, and some people will be receptive to it. Mm-hmm. But I think the prospects for the Obama administration ending without launching some kind of attack on Iran have improved considerably, and I'm now hopeful that in fact will happen, but we'll see.
Yeah, that would be the worst of all possibilities. There are also wonderful possibilities. We're not going to be able to get even if they're remote, of some kind of reconstruction of Middle East politics towards some kind of social democratic state. Surely the people of the Middle East, most of the people called the streets, would love that sort of conclusion. But we're not going to be able, that outcome of current struggles, we're not going to be able to get to it. Thanks a lot for talking to us today. Chris Tonsig,
sure,
of Middle East Reports.
Thanks for having me.
Right.
Lose their lives. to me. Whoa. It ain't nothing but a heartbreak. Whoa. Send only to the Undertaker.
And that's Edwin Starr with the song War, following up on the conversation about ending the war in Syria or calming it down, with Chris Stonesig and Bill Resnick here on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Stay tuned to the Old Mole for commentary on Obamacare, the government shutdown, and the future of food stamps. Right now, we have our well-read red, Fran Michel, to look at the assault on one way we help take care of each other, the pension system for state employees, or PERS. Here's Fran.
Last week, Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber called for a special legislative session to begin 8 a.m. September 30th, noting that we have an opportunity to combine cost savings from reforms to the public employee retirement system, PERS, and new revenue to restore lost school days. In other words, maybe we can remedy some of the draconian cuts made to education in recent years by slashing the pensions of retired teachers and other public workers, or, in other words, let's pit old people against children. The Oregon Center for Public Policy has noted that the purported revenue gains in the governor's package would only last until 2015, and the plan is mainly a tax cut for some of Oregon's wealthiest 1%. A spokesman for the governor acknowledged that the real long-term revenue will come from cuts to pensions. This is entirely in line with the findings in a set of reports released last week about the looting of public pensions across the U.S. In an article in Rolling Stone and in discussions on Democracy Now!, Matt Taibbi reports, "The siege of America's public fund money really began 40 years ago, in 1974, when Congress passed the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, or ERISA. In theory, this sweeping regulatory legislation was designed to protect the retirement money of workers with pension plans. ERISA forces employers to provide information about where pension money is being invested, gives employees the right to sue for breaches of fiduciary duty, and imposes a conservative prudent man rule on the managers of retiree funds, dictating that they must make sensible investments and seek to minimize loss. But this landmark worker protection law left open a major loophole. It didn't cover public pensions. Because they were under no legal obligation to be prudent in their investments, managers of public pensions began putting money into hedge funds and other risky investments, even though a lot of the prospectuses of these investments say, right in front in huge letters, these are high-risk investments. You may lose everything. It's exactly the opposite of what you want to put public money into. But these public pension funds were some of the most frequently targeted suckers upon whom Wall Street dumped its fraud-riddled mortgage-backed securities in the pre-crash years. When the crash came, then, the resultant loss of tax revenue plunged states everywhere into spiraling fiscal crises, and local governments suffered huge losses in their retirement portfolios. Those portfolios were also weakened by politicians often having failed to meet the annual required contribution as mandated by state law. For many state pension funds, a significant percentage of the money is built up by the workers themselves, who pitch in a part of their income, deferring wages or salary in favor of collecting retirement benefits later on. The rest of the fund is made up by taxpayer contributions. But in many cases, politicians illegally borrowed cash from public retirement funds to finance other budget needs. As Taibbi describes the game, politicians run for office, promising to deliver law and order, safe and clean streets, and good schools. Then they get elected, and instead of paying for the cops, garbage men, teachers, and firefighters they only just 10 minutes ago promised voters, they intercept taxpayer money allocated for those workers and blow it on other stuff. In The Plot Against Pensions, from the Institute for America's Future, David Sirota tells us more about what they've been blowing it on, and it's not generally cops, garbage collectors, teachers, and firefighters. States and cities have for years been failing to fully fund their annual pension obligations. They have used funds that were supposed to go to pensions to instead finance expensive tax cuts and corporate subsidies. That has helped create a real but manageable pension shortfall. Yet, instead of citing such a shortfall as reason to end expensive tax cuts and subsidies, Conservative activists and lawmakers are citing it as a reason to slash retiree benefits and preserve expensive corporate subsidies and tax breaks. In addition, the report finds that the amount states and cities spend on corporate subsidies and so-called tax expenditures is far more than the pension shortfalls they face. Yet conservative activists and lawmakers are citing the pension shortfalls and not the subsidies as the cause of budget squeezes. They're then claiming that cutting retiree benefits is the solution, rather than simply rolling back the more expensive tax breaks and subsidies. In addition to slashing retirement income for many pensioners who are not part of the Social Security system, many of the pension reforms being pushed by conservative activists are often more expensive and risky for taxpayers than existing pension plans. As Taibbi describes it, unions and voters are being told that a key solution to the fiscal crises is seeking higher yields or more diversity through alternative investments, whose high fees cost nearly as much as the cuts being demanded of workers, making this a pretty straightforward wealth transfer. A series of other middlemen are also in on this game, siphoning off millions in fees from states that are publicly claiming to be broke. Many of the alternative investments these funds end up putting their money in are hedge funds or private equity funds run by men and women who have lobbied politically against traditional union pension plans in the past, meaning union members have been giving away millions of their own retirement money essentially to fund political movements against them. Cuts to cost of living adjustments, sometimes, for instance in Rhode Island, equal the fees they're paying to hedge funds in the state. So essentially, it's a wealth transfer from teachers, cops, and firemen to billionaire hedge funders. Thus, not only did these workers already lose huge chunks of retirement money to huckster financiers in the crash, and not only are they now being asked to take the long-term hit for those years of greed and speculative excess, but in many cases, they're also being forced to sit by and watch helplessly as Wall Street shills are put in charge of their retirement savings. And in state after state, politicians are using scare tactics and lavishly funded PR campaigns to cast teachers, firefighters, and cops, not bankers, as the budget-devouring boogeymen responsible for the mounting fiscal problems of America's states and cities. Moreover, as Sirota notes, if the state-based crusade against public pensions is successful, it will probably fuel a renewed effort to privatize Social Security. If, as Marx told us long ago, the executive of the modern state is but a committee for managing the common affairs of the whole bourgeoisie, then current events should remind us how small that bourgeois class is. Americans like to think of ourselves as middle class, but the interlude of progressive taxation and public investments that relatively leveled economic inequalities between World War II and the 1970s has passed. It becomes increasingly clear today that the interests of the bourgeoisie are the interests of the 1% or less. Yet we can still challenge these actions. Last week, during public comment on Kitzhaber's proposals, current and retired public workers and union officials turned out in Salem to protest the cuts to cost of living increases, to describe the human impact of the plan, and to oppose the willingness to violate contractual obligations. It's not too late to contact your state representative and let them know if you think the governor's grand bargain amounts to grand theft. For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel.
And that was Well-Read Red, Fran Michel. The Well-Read Red is a regular feature of the Old Mole, bringing you a wealth of commentary from the left press and blogosphere about current issues. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Well, something else a good society would do to care for its people is to ensure that everyone gets good health care. Is the Affordable Care Act, soon to be implemented, a step in that direction? Here is the Old Mole's Jan Hocken to talk with Chris Lowe about that. Jan?
Welcome to KBOO this morning, Chris Lowe.
Thank you.
Well, as someone who's been working for many years, along with other activists, to fight for universal coverage, universal health care coverage, what's to celebrate in this plan? And then we can perhaps talk about its limitations and where to go from here.
Okay. Well, if you look at the Affordable Care Act overall, it has three pieces, and The biggest piece is actually the expansion of Medicaid in Oregon. That's the Oregon Health Plan. And this is just, I think, an unequivocal gain. What it is doing is it's expanding the principle of publicly funded health care, of social insurance and health care for low-income people. And it's bringing millions and millions of people into that form of getting their care. And then a second leg, which is worth celebrating, is that there's substantial regulations on the private insurance industry that affect not just the exchanges, but affect all insurance. So if you get your insurance through your employer or through some other kind of means, you benefit from these regulations as well. And then the third piece is the one that's rolling out starting tomorrow, which is the exchanges, Cover Oregon in Oregon. And those are more complicated. There are going to be a number of people who get benefit from that, but there are people, as we heard in the last hour, who say in multi-employer plans, their plans are going to be threatened. There are other complexities. And then on both the Medicaid piece and the exchanges, there is a kind of xenophobic element which keeps undocumented people, but also so-called legal immigrants who, you know, people who have permanent residency for the first 5 years that they're residents, they're also not eligible for these benefits. So, that's kind of the nutshell.
So the expansion of Medicaid is an important aspect of this. And can you say a little more about that and how to organize around that, around immigrants' rights?
Okay. Well, up until now, Medicaid has, at the federal level, you have to have been under 100% of the poverty level to be eligible. And the Affordable Care Act raises that eligibility income to, in effect, 138% of poverty. So there's a whole lot of low-wage workers who are included in that. And it's not as strong as it was meant to be because the Supreme Court ruled that states could opt out, and a number of more conservative states have indeed done that. So there are people who are going to fall through a huge hole that has been created by this kind of obstructionism. It's also in Oregon, the Oregon Health Plan had this lottery system, so only about 10% of technically eligible adults were able to get the Oregon Health Plan. And with the federal funding, everybody who's eligible will now be able to get on it. So it's a huge 200,000 or more people are going to be able to get health care through the Oregon Health Plan.
Go ahead.
So you know, as far as organizing goes, part of what we're doing in Healthcare for All Oregon is our basic principle is that healthcare is a human right. Everybody in, nobody out. So what we're doing is saying that, defend the gains of the Affordable Care Act, but this is not enough. So we have to keep, pushing so that everybody's really in, nobody's really out.
And of course, it's perhaps always the case with reforms that emerge from a crisis that you strengthen aspects of capitalism as you depend more and more on capitalism and the stability of capitalism to deliver basic services. And is there a risk here with insurance companies and the capital-intensive aspects of healthcare to be strengthened in this? Because overall, healthcare costs, particularly the technology-driven aspects of healthcare, are obscenely expensive in this country relative to other countries.
Right. Well,
will they be just doing more of the same?
Well, I mean, this is one of the problems with the exchange, is that what the exchange does is it subsidizes the expansion of the private insurance market, and it subsidizes the inefficiencies of the private insurance market. Healthcare really ought to be a public good. This is another one of our principles in HCAO, because what markets do is either drive people out at the margins, or if you bring subsidies in, then you're subsidizing private inefficiency. So when you're talking about the high technology things, this is a good example. The Portland area population of, you know, 1.5 million people, whatever it is, needs a certain number of machines that can do high-tech imaging, say, MRIs and CAT scans and so on. But we have a bunch of different hospital systems who are competing with one another, and each one of those hospital systems feels like it needs to have that kind of technology in order to compete. And then in order to pay it off, it has to charge prices that are higher than the actual any kind of cost related to actually doing the service. So,
and use them perhaps more than clinically necessary.
Right. And then charging fee for services as a way of getting compensated by the private insurance, you know, encourages use overuse as well. And then the insurance companies want to fight back about that by denying claims. So then you get this whole set of bureaucrats in both sides of that relationship who are fighting over whether the claim should be fulfilled or not. So when you look at, you know, traditional Medicare has about a 3% administrative cost. When you add in the semi-privatized Medicare Advantage plans, it gets up to about 7%. The estimates for the private insurance, you know, range between 20 and 30%. And it's not just the insurance, it's also on the provider side of that. So that's a measure of the scope of the inefficiency. So, you know, in terms of capitalism, well, what we're trying to do is move away from a market-based system to one where we're having a universal risk pool that cuts out a lot of this problem of administering inequality.
Well, given that many Republicans were among the ranks that supported this basic the basic elements of the Affordable Care Act years back when universal coverage was being debated. What's your assessment of the strength and the bitterness of and the aggressiveness of the opposition at this point, including threatening to shut down the government?
Well, I think that it's ultimately not about the Affordable Care Act per se. I think that on the one hand, they are trying to they have a long-term interest in resisting social insurance and healthcare. That their ideological commitments and the way that would raise the social wage is something that they're against. But on the other hand, I think that they right now we're in a situation where the ultra-right in the elected political realm is really trying to wreck the capacity of the state to deliver social needs to the people. And that's the real agenda that's going on here with the government shutdown. They're using Obamacare as their reason to shut it down now. If the Affordable Care Act weren't on the horizon now, they would find some other reason, you know. If the president would go along with their idea that, you know, to stop the individual mandate till next year, they'd come up with something in 2 weeks over the debt limit, because they're not actually interested in having the government work for us. They're trying to make us cynical about it. So as leftists, we need to have our analysis of the whole corporate regime and the corruption of the political system by corporate money, but we need to understand and have an analysis of the difference between two approaches within that, one of which accepts the idea of governance, at least, and the other of which is they're simply wreckers. They're just, and they have no moral compunction about what that does to people who need services, what it does to people who need health care, what it does to government employees, you know, and we need to recognize that distinction.
And one way that distinction is manifested is what's considered priority in right. keeping the government going. Can you say a little bit about those priorities?
Well, you know, I mean,
what's considered basic, like patrolling the borders.
Controlling the borders and the military. You know, I mean, we have this phenomenal empire of bases around the world. You know, the whole, just the scale of our military expenditure compared, you know, we spend more than the next 15 countries combined. It's a budget for world domination. It's not a defense budget. It's a domination budget. And that's the priority. And you know, we need to change that priority. You know, you can see it. Yeah, you know that's the biggest.
All the way down the line in terms of what's considered essential government services. Just in closing, how you're saying there's much to celebrate here, and in terms of the repoliticizing and kind of invigorating of the healthcare movement. How can people get involved, and what's happening here in Oregon around organizing? Can you just speak to that for a moment?
Yeah. Oregon is actually kind of one of the states that's in the forefront nationally. The national movement is a bit slowed down, but what we think is that the pathway through to getting national social insurance and healthcare is going to be through the states. And here in Oregon, Healthcare for All Oregon has a coalition that's statewide. We're over 80 organizations. The AFL-CIO just joined this past weekend, the state fed. We're building a movement that's going to be, you know, make it so that the legislators have to do what the people want. So if you want to get involved in the Portland area, a good contact is the Portland Jobs with Justice Healthcare Committee, which meets on the third Tuesday of each month. I think last hour somebody said the Thursday, but it's the third Tuesday of each month at the Oregon Federation of Nurses building. And then there's a website, hcao.org, which where you can get signed up to. If you sign up there, people will contact you.
That's for Healthcare for All Oregon.
Right, which website is a statewide coalition.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Chris Lowe. This is Jan Hawken, Chris Lowe, talking about about healthcare politics, and we have much more work to do.
Yeah. Thanks.
That's Closer to Fine by the Indigo Girls. And just before that, we heard Jan Hawken talking with Chris Lowe about matters related to healthcare here in Oregon. Coming up at 10 on KBOO, you'll hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein features a conversation with author Richard Heinberg, author of Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. At 11 on Health and Healthcare Forum, host Roberta Hall speaks with chiropractor lobbyist Vern Sabo about recent progress in expanding public healthcare reform to offer what has been called alternative care. And at 11:30, we hear about the War on Empathy with nutritionist Marion Nessel and linguist George Lakoff. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. If you're not currently a member, you can change that by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now, here's the Old Mole's Joe Clement with some thoughts about food stamps, who gets them and why, and the efforts to make them harder to get.
Thanks, Clayton. A little over a week ago, House Republicans passed a dramatic set of cuts and other restrictions to the food stamp program as part of an ongoing effort to work out the U.S. Farm Bill. Some of the most controversial parts entail reducing the program's spending by $40 billion over the next several years, pushing millions out of the program, and making it so states can require work and drug testing as criteria for eligibility. Regardless of the fact that many recipients already work, this requirement literally enforces low-wage work. That is, unless you participate in the popular delusion that living-wage jobs are there for all, for those who deserve them anyway. In terms of an older welfare reform debate, this was once called workfare. The program, rebranded years ago in technocratic argo as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, offers up to $200 a month to qualifying individuals. People who live and eat together qualify for more than that as a household, but with less than $200 per person for each additional person in the household. That's $50 or less per week, which I know can sometimes not really be enough. Millions who cannot find work depend on this program to gain access to food, while millions more on average draw anywhere between $10 and over half of the benefit. The move to change the name of the program underscores a paranoia American demagogues have about government dependency that's rarely applied to the economy. We depend on the market by historical enforced circumstances, though. We may hear about the blight of our economy and society posed by corporations, but not about the effect that pervasive exchange relations, wage labor, and private control of surplus value have on our moral intuitions. Drawing this comparison may invite nostalgia about getting back to the land and that other great American dream of cutting out the middleman. But even founding father black sheep Thomas Paine recognized in the 1700s that we passed the point in terms of population and economic development where that kind of distribution of lands and resource use makes sense. While the government may make us jump through hoops sometimes for its benefits, in fact, a lot of the time, they don't compare to the daily hoops workers are usually forced to jump through to make sure that they get a paycheck at the end of the month, at least in the food stamp program since the 2009 Recovery Act. If we are part of the vast majority of people in this country, specters of unemployment notwithstanding, we are subject to a kind of civilized form of tyranny called the business, and virtually all of us submit to a boss. There's something to be said about what Alex Gorovitch describes as worker republicanism, which is not to be confused with the Republican Party today. Worker republicanism refers to a strain of radical thought by Americans in the late 1700s and early 1800s that saw economic dependency of the dispossessed workers on employers as a version of the political dependency on feudal elites of an era just gone by. The modern food stamps program has never been quite so radical by design, but I've pointed out how it can be advocated at radical ends and a revaluation of economic and social values. Long before the program we basically know today that Bob Dole and George McGovern would advocate in the 1960s, Portland was actually home to a New Deal-era pilot for the food stamps program. Reading from the anti-hunger advocacy nonprofit's Partner for a Hunger-Free Oregon's website, quote, "Many people don't know that Portland, Oregon was an original pilot site for a project called the Food Stamp Plan that preceded the current program. The pilot operated from 1939 to 1943 and was seen as an innovative way to respond to severe hunger caused by the Depression while also supporting farmers. Portland area residents who were quote-unquote on relief purchased booklets of orange-colored stamps at a value equal to what they normally spent on food each month, or at least $4 per month per family member. Oregon orange food stamps could purchase, quote, any food usually sold in a grocery store, as well as, quote, household articles usually bought in grocery stores such as starch, soap, matches, and etc., but could not purchase alcohol, tobacco, or foods eaten at stores. For every $1 purchased in orange stamps purchased, 50 additional cents of blue stamps were received. Blue stamps could only purchase commodity surplus food. Grocers posted lists of the allowed surplus food, adding fresh vegetables as they came into season," end quote. This sounds both radical and reactionary. We've heard critics of SNAP who want to return to what they see as a less exploitable design where only certain major food groups are made accessible through the program. What's interesting about the original pilot program is how, in this description anyway, it connects consumers and farmers in a chain of economic interdependence. The food stamp program was originally conceived as a kind of stimulus program, and to be sure, that is how many liberals advocate the program today, but they are more likely to boast of it in terms of stimulating local economies in the abstract rather than actual actors in the economy. Local economy is a catch-all term that just as easily describes corporate monsters like Kroger that are quote-unquote local to an area as it does some mom-and-pop store. Charges of faux democratic appeal of consumer activism notwithstanding, there's something to be said for how food stamps allow us to talk about power and class power in the food system that actually exists. In her book Black, White, and Green, Alison Hope Alcon writes about racial and class inequalities in the so-called pursuit of a green economy, particularly in the context of small-scale farming and farmers' markets that cater to them. In that book, she studies two Bay Area farmers' markets, one very white and affluent in Berkeley, and one in West Oakland that was black and poor. She notes the struggles the West Oakland farmers' markets face, but also the phenomenon of food deserts that poor and often colored people face, too. She challenges redemptively pure images of farmers' markets as structured by a history of racist agricultural policy that disproportionately pushed black farmers into cities during the early 20th century. Combined with broader racial inequalities, greening the economy through farmers' markets is shown as a method of class and racial privilege. Curiously, though, she has little to say about food stamps as a purposefully atrophied organ of U.S. agriculture agricultural policy, much like unions have been a declining feature of the U.S. economy. On the whole, they create too much solidarity, it would appear from this ruling class. The idea that food stamps are political already exists, though, but only in the mouths of those whose cries of class warfare are on the side of the rich. The takeaway point today isn't that we should be able to revolutionize the food system through food stamps alone, but we cannot pretend like our hands are impossibly tied when it comes to system-wide responses to issues like hunger and malnutrition, but also the economic exploitation underlying them. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I've been Joe Clement.
And that's They Can Never Keep Us Down by Hazel Dickinson, following up on Joe Clement's comments about food stamps. And thanks to Joe for that, and that's all The Mole has for us today. Many thanks to Chris Tonsig and Bill Resnick for their analysis of issues in the Middle East, to Fran Michelle for her review of the debate about the Oregon PERS and school funding, to Chris Lowe and Jan Hocken for their discussion of the new health care law, and again to Joe Clement for his commentary on food stamps, as well as his adept engineering of our show. If there's any part of today's show or of a past show that you'd like to hear again or recommend to friends, you can find it on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge. I've been your host today. Join us again next Monday for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective. And stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
We have a dynamic community of 500 volunteers doing everything from front desk work, janitorial work, community reporting, hosting information booths, clerical support, news writing, documentary making, engineering live music, operating soundboards, working in the music library, and many, many other things. KBOO absolutely depends on volunteers to carry out the work of the station. We are always looking for new volunteers. We have monthly volunteer orientations, which is the first step in getting involved. Contact KBOO Volunteer Coordinator Annie Haynes about the next volunteer orientation at 503-231-8032 extension 231 or at volunteer@kboo.org.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, September 30th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. The U.S. government looks like it is over the cliff and out to sea, all because Texas Republicans hijacked Dr. Seuss, a man who would be thoroughly disgusted with the behavior of, let's just go ahead and say it, Republicans. I've heard commentators in the liberal or neoliberal, some semi-centrist ilk who say that blame should be equally parsed out between the two sides. And I think that the actual responsibility for this brouhaha falls on the